You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
Quail get hammered by predators all the time, but yet they can increase like 400 times in a year with a great spring nesting season. They can double clutch. They can really come back. They're resilient little dudes. And I just really love everything about them. The biology of the way they covey up, the way they have their fall shuffle. They're just a really neat animal. And I really do think that they are, and I said it before, that they're kind of a barometer of the ecosystem health. They really show you what's missing. If they're not there, there's a problem in the landscape and you need to address it.
Hey, Bird Dog Babes. My name is Courtney Bastian and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here to share with you the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world, mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, raising, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Brocky Italiano. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. Patreon patrons, mark your calendars for Thursday, March 18th at 7:30 Central Standard Time. We are celebrating 1 year of the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. Whoop whoop! We're having happy hour with an Ask Me Anything session. Oh boy. Some pretty cool giveaways and a big announcement. There's some exciting stuff in the works and you're going to be the first ones to hear about it. Head over to patreon.com/thebirddogbabe to join us next Thursday, March 18th. My guest today is Elsa Gallagher. She is a biologist for the Bee and Butterfly Habitat Fund and an avid bird hunter and field trialer. She's down from an even dozen hunting dogs to a mere 9 these days. We discuss her Vizsla named Hatch and his recent placement at the AKC National Championship, along with her lifelong dedication to quail, as well as her most recent project with the Bee and Butterfly Habitat Fund, and how you can qualify for free seed with their Seed a Legacy program. All right, let's get after it. This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan. What makes a great bird dog is genetics, training, and nutrition, and that's why I trust and feed Purina Pro Plan. With over 500 nutritionists, veterinarians, and scientists on staff, ProPlan delivers a full spectrum of performance and specialized dog food formulas to help bird dogs like yours excel at every stage of life. Purina supports us, the breeders, owners, and trainers, the events we compete in, our national breed clubs, canine health research, and our committed partners to conservation groups such as Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, and Ducks Unlimited. 95 out of the top 100 dogs are fueled by the advanced nutrition of Purina Pro Plan. This episode is also presented by Boss Shot Shells. Copper-plated bismuth Boss provides a better, more effective non-lead option than steel and are safe to use in Grandpa's gun. Available in 10, 12, 16, 20, 28 gauge, and 410, direct-to-consumer pricing and cases shipped right to your door. Shoot Boss. Pattern your shotgun to make more clean and ethical shots, reduce crippling, and remove lead from the uplands, wetlands, and all lands. Find out more at BossShotShells.com. A big shout out to the people and the partners that are helping me to keep the MP3s rolling for this podcast. My Patreon patrons, the bread and butter, the peeps, the community of like-minded individuals that are eager to learn and offer to contribute. Join us for $5 per month on patreon.com/thebirddogbabe for exclusive discounts, content, and live Q&A sessions. 5% of your contribution goes to the AKC Canine Health Foundation, and another 5% goes to conservation. Dakota 283 unparalleled protection for your dog's travel to and from your next adventure. My favorite is the G3 kennel, which has a recessed handle on top that makes it easy for me to lift in and out of my truck. The keyed panel latching door makes me feel at ease on trips when I have to leave dogs in my truck when I stop for fuel. An added bonus is the drain hole in the back, which makes cleaning a breeze when my dog has been run hard and put away wet. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. And by Siren, shotguns for women. Siren carries the only full line of women's shotguns. They are dedicated to providing the equipment and knowledge that make shooting and hunting more enjoyable and less stressful. Newer season hunter, Siren offers multiple options that fit right out of the box. No more compromises. Go to SirenUSA.com and check out all the options available for upland, waterfowl, sporting, and trap shotguns. And while you're there, say hello to Julia, Siren's new 12-gauge sporting that is one of the most stunning shotguns I've laid my eyes on. Also by Big Frig, roto-molded coolers with heavy-duty latches, dual stainless steel lock plates that double as bottle openers. They also have dry boxes, tumblers, and growlers, and my favorite, the ability to customize the tumblers and coolers. Head to thebirddogbabe.com/bigfrig to view the wide array of sizes and colors available. There's a Badlands cooler perfect for your way of life. Elsa, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Courtney. I'm glad to be here today.
I'm excited to have you. You are fresh off a pretty amazing weekend right now. So let's get into it. Tell me all about that boy Hatch of yours.
All right, I will. It's hard to describe him in a few words, so I'll give you more than a few probably.
Okay.
Hatch is our Vizsla, our redhead, and he is a four-year-old incredible bird dog. He comes from some really great parents out of Kansas and Iowa. And he happened to have a really great run last week at the AKC All Breed Championship. And he, in a 60-dog stake, he took third place. So
it's incredible. Holy cow.
It was pretty incredible. His sister, Littermate, took fourth.
Wow.
And his other sister from the same litter, not my dog, she's owned by a young man named Sean Van Coten, and Sean won the actual horseback championship with Hatch's littermate Tori.
The week before, right?
Yep. It was a pretty cool deal.
That's amazing. So were you there to watch Hatch's runs?
Yeah. Yes. So okay. I will tell you, it's kind of a funny situation with Hatch. He tends to run a little differently when I'm there. I'll admit it. He's kind of a mama's baby. I haven't tried to make him that way, but he just kind of is. So when I handle him, he runs a little bit closer and he tends to check back in more frequently, which is not a trait that you want to see on a horseback run. So my husband agreed to run him. My husband, who's only run dogs in three different trials in his life, ran Hatch. And
that's impressive.
Did an incredible job with him. I served on the scouting gallery watching part of the run. And it was pretty incredible. Hatch had a great run. It was wonderful to watch. He's finally putting all his pieces together. He's a great wild bird dog. He's just still kind of thinks he can catch those birds and he should try occasionally. And so we still have to have that talk occasionally. But he's got so much bird drive. He rivals my English pointer, and that's saying a lot because our English pointer is a very nice dog as well. He also took third place in the AKC championship the last time it was held in Arkansas. So 3 years back, the pointer did. So he's following in his older brother's from another mother footsteps.
That's incredible. And it was 1 hour stake, right? 1 hour walking stake for,
yep.
And is he out of Laura Miller's bull?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I thought I caught that in there.
Yeah. Have you interviewed her, Courtney? Because she would also be.
Yeah. Not yet.
And the Scottish accent, it'll get you.
she's another one on the docket. Absolutely.
She's an incredible lady and an incredible woman. Mm-hmm. she works for USDA, and she's dealing with some of the COVID issues, and she's a researcher, and she is she's sharp as a tack. And her dog Bull is a very nice Vizsla. And then the other half of the breeding comes from Colby, Kansas, from Southwind, and they had a dog named Kinsey, and she's probably one of the birdiest, best wild bird Vizslas that I have ever seen in my life and hunted behind. And Kinsey, that was her last litter, was this litter with Hatch and Tori and Kimber. And just a wonderful litter. These dogs have turned out really great.
Wow, that's exciting. And what a great age, too, 4 years old.
Yeah.
And he's got years ahead of him to do that. In preparing for that, has Hatch been with you that you guys are conditioning and training him?
So he has been. So I work with my sister and her husband. They run Perfection Kennels in Missouri. And so Hatch has been through every one of their training programs. He goes to summer camp in the Dakotas with John Han. And so he's been with them through all of his breaking process. You know, I may have held the transmitter, but they certainly did all of the talking and all of the, this is how we need to work with him. And here's what you do to improve this. So they actually had him right before the Nationals, but because we had that really, really bad weather. So I'm talking, you know, below zero temperatures in Missouri, which was crazy. And like a foot of snowfall over at their place. I actually kept him a little bit longer with me. They had a bunch of clinics down in Texas. So I was actually conditioning him and getting him ready for the trial myself. But he went to them about a week before in good shape, ready to run. And then they took some of the edges off and really got him going. I can't say enough about them. I would have none of the accomplishments with my dogs, any of my dogs, including my first one, which was a Vizsla that I earned a Master Hunter title on. And that's when I originally met John Han of Perfection Kennels.
Okay.
I have none of the success I have without them. Zero.
That's amazing. And I just put the two and two together. You just told me that your sister's with Jessica. So you had just mentioned that you met John. So did you and your sister meet him at the same time?
No, not at all. In fact, I introduced them. I've known John, oh my gosh, it's been probably 15 years, maybe a little bit more than that. Way back in the day when I worked for Missouri Department of Conservation, I met John. He volunteered at one of our quail, that way back when there were still Quail Unlimited, he volunteered at a Quail Unlimited event and taught a training session on dogs. And that's where I originally met him. He helped me with my then first dog, my English Pointer. And then he also helped me with to earn my Master Hunter title on my Vizsla. And then years later, my sister actually went to work for John. So it was crazy. They've been married a couple of years now. They're a great couple. They're kind of that deal where you meet your soulmate later in life.
Right.
And wonder what you were doing all that other time. But that's the two of them. They're like that. So I love being around them. Love spending that time with them together. They're a neat couple.
Yeah. I've caught on to some of their live training events that they did. You know, over the last year, and those are really neat. They're doing some pretty cool things there.
Yeah, they try to do a Facebook Live every Tuesday and Thursday. During the midst of the really, you know, lockdown during COVID, they were actually doing a Facebook Live for an hour every day at lunch. And you know, to me, a trainer that will open up their home like that, and just, John never high grades the dogs he shows you either. They're in the trailer because they're in training that day, and he just shows you whatever he's doing with whatever dog he's got at the time. And it's like Forrest Gump says, life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. That with John when he opens that trailer. He doesn't know which, you know, whether it's going to be the 2-year-old Wyme or whether it's going to be the 6-month-old Vizsla. I mean, he'll show you whatever he's doing at whatever level they're at. And it's just interesting to watch, I think.
And I think that's a sign of a great confident trainer as well, somebody that can do that. And I know people appreciate and can relate to that more of seeing the struggles that trainers have with dogs and getting them through it, how the process looks, instead of having that start to finish and not knowing what happens in between.
And Courtney, I know you know that with your family history, but it's not the dogs, I don't think, that are as difficult. It's the people. I think me as an amateur handler, I am way more difficult for them to deal with than my dog. The dog's pretty common sense. He wants to catch birds, and we need to make him stand there and learn that that's his job, and not take away any of that fire and desire. And John can do that all day long, but getting me to be able to teach my dog to do that is a lot harder for him. So he's, yeah. And I think they're more proud. I know when they left the Arkansas Championship, I think they were more proud of their amateur handlers and how their handlers actually handled their own dogs, like Jeff and I handling Hatch. And yeah, it's easy enough to hand him the whistle and let him handle your dog for you. But for us to all be successful and do it ourselves has been really a lot of fun for me. Yeah.
What did Hatch's season look like this past year? Do you do wild bird hunting with him, knowing that you're coming into a competitive field trial competition in the spring?
Well, Courtney, he's my bird dog before he's a trial dog for me, for sure. Absolutely. We start in Nebraska with prairie chickens early. We love prairie chicken hunting in Nebraska. It's one of our favorite things to do. And then we hit New Mexico this year. My nephew lives in New Mexico. It's where I grew up. And we went down there and hunted scaled quail and gambles quail with him. So oftentimes Hatch will come right back from hunting to go right into a trial. And it's probably difficult for him, but it's what we have the dogs for. We enjoy the hunting so much that for us, that's kind of first. And then the trialing comes in second. And John will always tell us, you know, he always says that, you know, a good bird dog is going to be a good bird dog. They got to find birds at a trial first, then they got to be broke. So you hunt them as much as you can on wild birds, and that's going to teach them more than anything you could probably do in a training pen.
Absolutely. Are you finding yourself being a bit more forgiving on wild birds? Are you not shooting them unless they're pointing? What's your theory?
Is that going to sound bad if I say that? Yes.
No.
I killed two birds off of the conservation area that I live 20 yards from this year. I do not shoot a ton of wild quail. I just enjoy seeing the dogs work them, and I enjoy seeing them work them again and again. And so I don't have to harvest a bird to feel successful. Now when I go out prairie chicken hunting, we do, the limit's rather low anyway. And so we do harvest birds there, and I will shoot a quail here and there, and pheasants. I don't know why I have that different opinion of quail, but I just don't like to kill a lot of them. I just don't.
I mean, do you think it's a little bit to do with the fact that you've dedicated nearly your entire life to quail? That might be it.
Yeah, Courtney, you know, when I worked as a quail, when I first came to Missouri and worked as a young biologist, as a temporary employee making, you know, $7 an hour for the conservation department, I was on a quail research project where you had to, you know, nab the wild quail, you trapped them, then you put radio collars on them. And I was actually one of the radio collar technicians that would go out at night. We'd pinpoint the coveys, and then you throw a giant net on them and catch the rest of the covey. And then you'd get all their body measurements. So you'd be stuffed in the back of this pickup truck. And it wasn't even a double cab. It was like the cab and a half or whatever those are called. And you'd be stuffed in the back part of that with this big machine that you had to wrap these little quail up like little sausages in a pantyhose to get their body fat measurements, and you'd run them through this machine. So imagine being shoved in that little tight area with, say, 15 or so wild quail that are just, you know, freaking out the whole time and a little bit stinky, a little bit poopy. At the end of that quail research project, after 2 years, I was ready to harvest every quail I would see because I was just so tired of quail. But I really did come to admire them. They are resilient little creatures. And I've always said they're like a barometer of the ecosystem health. If you have good quail numbers, you really have some good habitat usually. And I just really love them. I love seeing them. I love hearing them. I'm so excited. I heard a pair last night here on my place. And I love seeing wild birds. And quail just have a little place in my heart, I guess. I started with scaled quail when I was in college at New Mexico State, helping a grad student work on scaled quail projects. And Oh, I just love them. They're just, they're neat birds.
So what came first, the bird dogs or the quail?
The quail came first. And I met Zeke. I worked with Tom Daly. He's a wildlife biologist, retired now. Worked for the Missouri Department of Conservation as their quail biologist for years and years. And I worked for him on this project, and he had a big old black and white male pointer named Zeke. And old Zeke used to get away from Tom a lot, on these projects. But one of the side projects that Tom had us doing was running transects through the middle of this conservation area, running bird dogs down the transects to point the quail. And my job, like I said, was radio telemetry. So I would go out and find a covey. The dogs would run these transects with their owners. Zeke never ran the transect next to Tom. He would run three transects over, and we'd be lucky if we ever found Zeke at the end of the day. But he could, when he did find quail, he'd be there for quite a while waiting for you to find him. He was a neat dog, but I just fell in love with him. He was beautiful, and I just thought, man, I need a dog like that one of these days. So did
you guys have GPS units back then?
You know, I'm trying to think. It wasn't way back then, Courtney. It's not like I didn't ride dinosaurs to work every day. But it was in, I think I started working for the department after 94? Yeah. Yeah, it was quite a few years ago. So okay. I think they may have had, I don't think Zeke ever wore a GPS collar, because I mean, you could see him run away forever if you were in the flatlands. He would go a ways. But it was beautiful. And I thought, I'm going to get me one of those.
Yeah.
The first thing I did when I graduated Private Lands Training Academy was I already looked at the litter, found the right litter, because I'm a firm believer that genetics are huge. I'd found the right litter with an LHU female and crossed out with Dunn's Fearless Bud. So a nice pointer mix. And I'd already put my deposit down. And when I went to pick her up, she was outside of the whelping box. And that was the day I graduated private lands training. I went to get her that was my gift to myself. And she was outside the whelping box. And I thought, well, that's just a little strange. They must've left her out or something. And it was till she was about 5 months old, I learned that no, she could climb and out of her 6 foot fence. And she put my husband and I to the test. She ate our couch one year.
Oh my gosh.
On the whole thing. It just broke into the house got over a chain link fence. This was at 4.5, 5 months old, climbed over the 6 foot kennel, went through the screen door and ate our couch in our house, just threaded it, the whole couch, every piece of cushion on that couch was shredded. And then she was sitting on the front porch when we got home. And I yelled at Jeff. I said, Jeff, you left the gate open. You let the dog out. And then we walked in that house and it was just a mess.
Oh my gosh.
It was like that all of her life. Her whole life was spent doing things like that. She could get on the counter and then onto the refrigerator. On top of the refrigerator.
Talented. Did you run her in any trials?
I'm trying to think if I don't think that I did. I think I was looking at NASTRA as a potential for her. I did. I ran her in a couple of NASTRA trials, the shoot to retrieve, but I never worked with her on any of the AKC stuff or any of the junior hunter, master hunter, anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't run her in trials. I ran her in a few Bird Hunter United events, which were fun and in a really neat group of people, a lot like the shoot to retrieve group. But here in the Midwest, and they're just a really nice group of folks. And we've really enjoyed running dogs and trials with them. But yeah, it was kind of before I knew much about bird dog trials. So we just wild bird hunted her a lot.
Okay. Yeah. I'm impressed with her being your first bird dog, how much research you did into finding that line. And cause that's a really well-known, very reputable line. And not many first-time bird dog owners put in that much research into it.
I am firmly of the belief that you get what you pay for. I also, that said, Courtney, I foster bird dogs for the local animal shelter for several rescues. I have found and kept used bird dogs, recycled dogs, I call them, that have turned into fine bird dogs and good bird dogs. But if I am going to give myself the advantage by buying a well-bred dog that has parents that I know are going to hunt, and I would rather do that than I would take a crapshoot and hope that something's going to maybe be birdie or not be gun shy or not gun shy, but not have feather aversion or have issues. I would rather err on, if I'm going to spend my money, I want to buy the best breeding that I can get. And I feel like I've done that, I've done that multiple times, and Hatch is the most recent example that we have of a really, really nice breeding that should turn out well if you don't mess them up.
Yeah.
And so after her, what was your second bird dog breed? Did you get another pointer?
I did not. We got a GSP, the next one. Okay. Odyssey Kennels, the Odyssey mm-hmm. lines. We had an Odyssey dog.
Okay.
It was a heck of a retriever. Just a wonderful dog. We loved her to death.
And so what's...
That was her only fault. She was really, she didn't have a lot of faults. She was a really easy dog. But she died at 8, which was way too young for me. And then we got a Vizsla, mm-hmm. our first Vizsla. Rooster Cogburn was his name. That was before I knew much about pheasant hunting, Courtney. I hadn't really pheasant hunted much, just mostly quail. And so I named him Rooster Cogburn. And that was apparently the worst thing you could ever do when you're pheasant hunting and people are yelling, rooster, rooster. I didn't know that. I had not been pheasant hunting at that point in my life.
Yeah.
So,
did you pheasant hunt with him then?
I did.
Yeah.
Multiple states, multiple times. He was a real methodical hunter too. He was probably the smartest dog I'll ever own and would do anything in the world for me. He was an incredibly intelligent, wanting to please dog. I don't think he would have made it in horseback field trials. He didn't have that range and that high level of desire that I see in my recent dog. But he absolutely would do anything I wanted him to do. And he was just a wonderful dog. He was a great dog.
What do you have on your string right now?
So we have Hatch, who is 4, and we have Pike. Pike is out of a Four Rivers Commander and a shoot to retrieve dog. He's a nice pointer. And then we have Jenny, who is a sister to the dog that won the AKC horseback 3 years back, sister to Nova. And she's a short hair.
Okay.
And then we have, we have very few right now. We're usually at 10 or 12 dogs, but we have 4 beagles. We like to do a lot of rabbit hunting and we like to do a lot of youth hunts. And rabbit hunting with kids is an easy way to get them outdoors and have them have a really positive experience.
Oh, I bet.
We do a lot of rabbit hunting. And so, yeah, we have another short hair. And then we have I was talking about recycled dogs. We've got a recycled lab that we really enjoy this year. We've put him on some ducks and some snipe and pheasants, and he's had a really good first year with us. He's a young guy, only 2. So
aww.
He's a lot of fun.
Do you do waterfowl hunting then too?
I do. That's more of my husband's thing than mine because there's not much in this world I hate more than getting up early. I just don't love it. It's not something I'm ever going to love. I do it for whistle counts when I can listen for quail in the morning and, for surveys, whistle surveys and stuff, but I would prefer not to get up early when it's frigid out.
Okay. So
I go with him every couple times every year. And I forced myself to take the dog this year when he couldn't. So I did do it for, his first year, but I don't love to get up early. It's just not, it's not one fault that I have.
Well, at least in Missouri, it's not too cold because when I think of duck hunting from being in Wisconsin and now out here, it's early cold mornings, but you guys have it more mild there, at least weather-wise.
Yes, we do. And those mornings I treasure. I will go out on those mornings and I just don't love it. I hate getting up early. I will get up though. It's quite funny because I really hate getting up early, but turkey season, there's nothing that will stop me from going every morning of turkey season until I've, either not found turkeys or got my turkeys. I will get up early for turkeys. I love to turkey hunt.
I'm torn on turkey hunting right now. but I got my first one this fall. So,
oh, that's not even near as fun. It's
not. It was
different.
It was awful. I know, but I spent six spring seasons hunting turkeys, and they skunked me every time. So I took the fall into my hands and took it for what it was worth. But now I feel a little bit more skilled and prepared, and I'm ready to get out there this spring and defy the turkey.
No judgment, Courtney. It's just, I don't love the fall hunting because I just love the sound of them gobbling and coming in and strutting. And
oh yeah,
I just that really gets me excited. And I love the turkey hunt. I'm almost sorry I ever started, because there's so many other things in my life that I should be doing. And then turkey season, at least in Missouri, it closes at 1 o'clock. So
okay,
the rest of the day to actually work and get things done. But
it's a productive schedule then.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you make that transition from having your dogs as your personal gun dogs to horseback field trialing? How does that happen?
Yeah, it happens differently for everybody, right? I'm sure. Everybody has a different path. But for me, I was lucky. Like I said, John Han at Perfection Kennels met my sister, and my sister got interested. So my sister growing up, all she wanted to do was be a horse trainer. That was her life goal. And she trained at the highest level of competition, the world level, with reining horses, quarter horses. And she is what I will call the horse whisperer. I mean, she knows more about horses than anyone I've ever met. And she's just incredibly good with them, knowing what's going to happen and what you should do and how to react. And so I always knew I would be safe around the horses that she had. And so I went to my first field trial actually when she was working for John at Perfection Kennel, and she had brought along one of her quarter horses. And I got to go on a trial and see what that was like. And since then, and I got more interested in it, and Jessica helped me find a horse. And now my husband's getting interested in it, so he's coming along. And it's just, I don't know if I would have made that transition near as easily if I had to, you know, just count on myself to find the horses and to make that transition to the horseback. I did a lot of walking trials before that. I mean, I still do walking trials. I still enjoy that as well. But having that safe horse for me is huge. So, yeah.
Do you have horses of your own now?
So sort of. I have two. Yes. I say sort of when I say that, Courtney, because my husband laid the law down and he said, we will not own horses on this piece of property. And I didn't disagree with him. That was the one thing when we got married, he said he didn't want to have horses or care for horses on our place. And you know, that's fair enough. So my horses get to stay at my sister's, and she cares for them and takes care of them for us during the year. And we get to ride them at the trials and try and help out where we can around the place when we can.
Perfect. So,
yeah, it kind of is. I mean, we wouldn't have them here probably. If she couldn't keep them, I don't know if we'd be doing horseback stuff. So it's been a real blessing for us that she's been willing to do that.
Yeah. Did you and your sister grow up? It sounds like you guys had horses there maybe growing up,
yeah,
but did you grow up and did your parents hunt? Did you guys hunt?
So we did not at all. No one in my family, my grandparents on my mom's side, my grandpa was a hunter. My grandpa Ricker, he was an avid waterfowler. And I believe he probably fished a lot too. He was just an interesting guy. Worked for the oil industry on the pipelines. They lived in Indonesia for quite a while. My mom did. So she had an interesting childhood growing up. But my dad, very city, was in Northern California, grew up there, and he never fished, never hunted. Went right into the Navy when he got out of high school, and just never did it as a family at all. We fished a little bit and we camped. We liked to go camping. And I didn't start hunting until I went to college at New Mexico State, and I dated a guy that liked to turkey hunt. So I ended up going turkey hunting with him a few times, and then really got really excited about quail hunting, bird dogs when I came to Missouri. That was kind of what turned it on for me.
Does Jessica hunt too?
He does now.
Yeah.
He's an avid turkey hunter.
That's awesome.
And she did not hunt when she had boys, two boys, my wonderful nephews, Chase and Clay. They are incredible kids. They're young men now, but not kids anymore. But they both learned to hunt, and they're both successful young men now. And Clay is a forester in New Mexico. So he kind of followed in my steps a little bit, you know, kind of wildlife forestry hand in hand. He does a lot of work out there, and he has two bird dogs, two German Shorthairs out of the Odyssey lines as well. And they're active little bird finding fools. So, and Chase was more into the horses and that kind of things. And he has a little border collie puppy now, he and his girlfriend. So then he lives in Colorado. He's an air traffic controller.
Oh, neat. So I could talk bird dogs with you all day, but I want to talk about your other passion in life, the quail, this bird species that you have dedicated so much of your life to. I mean, what is it about those little birds that you just love so much and you do so much for them?
That's a tough one because there's so many neat things about bobwhite quail. And I just think, you know, they're a native bird. They're like, I like to call them like the chicken nuggets of the world. Everything eats them. Like everything eats a quail. There's not anything out there that if it eats a animal, it won't eat a quail. Quail get hammered by predators all the time. But yet they can increase like 400 times in a year with a great spring nesting season. They can double clutch. They can really come back. They're resilient little dudes. And I just really love everything about them, the biology of the way they covey up, the way they have their fall shuffle. They're just a really neat animal. And I really do think that they are, and I said it before, that they're kind of a barometer of the ecosystem health. They really show you what's missing. If they're not there, there's a problem in the landscape and you need to address it. And so I just think they're an interesting little bird.
Yeah. And so in Missouri there, do you guys have good populations?
It depends. You know, in areas where landowners are doing work on their private property or on conservation areas that are being managed for quail, we do have good numbers. As long as we don't get hit with extended periods of ice and snow, that we usually have pretty good numbers of quail on areas that are being managed. But with quail, you have to do management like every year. You can't, it's not like deer management where you can sit on the couch and turn on your remote control and still sit in your deer stand and have a really successful hunt, you know, that next fall. With quail, if you're not doing some habitat tweaking or some work or some burning, then the habitat's going to get away from you and it's going to be beyond what's useful to them. So you really kind of have to manage almost every year, at least every other year, to have good quail numbers.
So what does like high quality quail habitat consist of? What should we be doing to help that year to year? What do they need?
So for the most part, it's just broken down into three parts. You have to have good nesting cover. You have to have good roosting cover at night. And then you have to have good brood rearing cover. Of those three, in my opinion, the brood rearing cover is the most important. To have open areas where chicks can move around and not get chilled, which means not too much vegetation, because if they get dewy and wet and it's cold, they can actually freeze. It's crazy. They're very vulnerable when they're very small. And all they eat for the first couple of weeks is soft insects. So they have to have a good food source, and it has to be open enough of a canopy for them to move around in there and get great food. It can't be a monoculture of grasses. It can't be turf grass type stuff, because then they get wet and they can't walk on bare ground. So if they can walk on bare ground and have overhead canopy and have a lot of bugs, you're providing probably the best stuff you can for creating habitat like that, because they'll nest in less than ideal conditions. But the brood rearing, if they don't have food and they don't have good brood rearing cover, they're not going to make it.
What about, you said, like, for predators, that there's so many of them. Is there anything different with habitat that would help them one way or the other?
Sure. Predators? So a good, what we call a covey headquarters or a good shrubby cover is really important to quail as well. It's escape cover. And you want to have that really be bare underneath so that the birds can move and get out and then fly to escape if they get into the cover and they're being chased. So that probably would be the fourth thing I think would be of importance. And I know a lot of studies in Missouri have shown that good quality cover like that is really important to them in the wintertime as well, so that they have places to escape predation. Mm-hmm. And they have places to kind of that would have more thermal cover in the wintertime.
So your involvement right now, well, I guess you tell us about that, where you first started as a biologist and then where you are right now.
Well, sure. So when I finished my bachelor's degree at New Mexico State, I came up to work in Missouri on quail projects. And I worked for the Missouri Department of Conservation for 2 years as a wildlife technician on a quail project, which just solidified my interest in quail. Then I decided to go back get my master's degree, and I worked on river otters for my master's, and then got a job with the conservation department working as a private lands biologist, working with landowners on improving their habitat for wildlife. And I worked in what we called an open lands initiative kind of area where we had a lot of interest in quail. So it fit right into my interests. And that was the year that the conservation department first stood up their private lands division. So I was one of the members of the first private lands biologists in the state here in Missouri. And I worked for them for several years. Then I became the state quail coordinator for MDC. Really enjoyed that role, helping the biologists make quail a priority on a lot of the areas in the state and working with private landowners as well. And then the opportunity came up to work for Quail Forever. Quail Forever started in 2005, and in 2006, I was hired as a regional biologist for Missouri and Kansas. I had Arkansas and then a few other states as well, but for the most part, I worked in Missouri and in eastern Kansas. Mm-hmm. And really enjoyed doing that work, and started the Quail Forever biologist program, the Farm Bill biologist in Missouri. Hired some really incredible young people to work in the state. And then I went up to the national office for my last year and a half with PF and QF, and worked with the National Youth Leadership Council and worked on the education and outreach team. So I learned a lot working up there at the national office. But then I was given the opportunity to work for my previous supervisor at Pheasants Forever, who had started a not-for-profit called the Bee and Butterfly Habitat Fund. And he started that in conjunction with Pheasants Forever. And then he left to further that along, and then hired me almost 2 years ago to work for him and work for the Bee and Butterfly Habitat Fund in providing free seed for landowners to do habitat projects. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the perfect job. You know, you get to go out there and you raise funds, kind of like I did at Quail Forever. Then you get to be a biologist and you get to do the biology part of things and work with people. And you get to really help people to put great quality habitat on their property. And it's not just for landowners. Our program is for cities, we're doing a lot of solar projects. We work with utilities and rights of ways. It's just a really great project or program that we have. It's called Seed a Legacy Program. And it's really useful, I think, for landowners. And we really wanted to provide some good quality seed mixes for people that were affordable. And so we provide it free now if they qualify, and qualifying is pretty easy as long as you have the site prep done. Mm-hmm. But it's a great program.
Yeah, I'm excited to dig into more information on that. So how long did you work for Quail Forever?
Oh, a little over 13 years.
Wow. And in a little bit of previous conversation, were you not the first female biologist?
I believe that I was, yes.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing.
There's some really neat folks working at PF at that time. And I made a lot of friendships working with all the people I did. And, you know, Courtney, you and I were talking just a little bit about this and asking about, you know, your, as you move into the realm of what is traditionally kind of a man's realm, you know, wildlife biology wasn't, there weren't a whole lot of female wildlife biologists around when I was around, when I started, and there weren't any at Pheasants Forever. And when you would go to a chapter meeting and you'd be talking to these guys about their chapter or helping them do fundraising or helping them set up youth events or something, it was a little disconcerting because you're the only woman there usually in general. And that's not the case, I don't think, so much anymore. And I just really love the fact that there was a lot of ponytails at that AKC National Championship this year. A lot that's of people awesome. With ponytails. And and I don't mean the man bun kinds. I mean, women. A lot of women out there handling their own dogs and scouting and just really, really doing a great job of it. And I see more and more of that. And I think these bird dogs have dragged a bunch of women into this field and into this having interest. And I think sometimes you get that dog and you don't really know what you've got. And then you realize you're going to have to learn to hunt or trial because your dog wants to do it. Yeah. And I've seen many a friend that has gotten sucked into that.
It is. It's definitely. And then they go and, you know, give you a ribbon at the first event you go to. And that's really a hook, line and sinker. Yep. So that's one way to do it. So back on what you're doing now, I first learned about this at the Pheasant Fest, like we were talking about earlier, when I was in Schaumburg. I think up on the second level, there was a room that really focused on the pollinators, the bees.
Pollinator Plaza.
Is that what it was?
Pollinator Plaza.
I thought it was something specified for it. Yeah, it was fantastic. And that's when I first kind of learned about this whole concept. And tell our listeners, what is a pollinator and why are they so important?
Sure. So I'll ask you a question and I don't, it's totally off the cuff because I don't know the answer to it.
Okay.
Courtney, do you like chocolate?
Yes. No?
Do you drink coffee?
I do every morning. Yep.
Do you, and this might be the crazy one because I'm from New Mexico, so I definitely am a yes on this one, but do you eat avocados?
I do.
I knew that would be a touchy one.
Guacamole. So I don't eat them straight up, but they do in guacamole. Yep.
Well, I grew up in New Mexico, so it's almost in your, you know, you just have to like the avocado at that point, but because it's coming in everything. But, you know, if you didn't have pollinators, we would not have the amount of coffee that we have. We wouldn't have chocolate at any level. We wouldn't have avocados, apples, no almonds. It's just, you know, pollinators can be anything from a bat, a bee, a butterfly, a beetle, anything that moves that pollen from the male to the female flower is a pollinator. Some plants are wind pollinated. But for us, what we're trying to do at the Bee and Butterfly Fund is to work on creating more habitat so that we can create more space for pollinators to grow. And for us, we have a big concern about honeybees, and we're concerned about native bees as well, but we're also highly concerned about the monarch butterfly and the declines we've seen there. So really, Courtney, when you look at it, it's like my whole life working on the quail projects and working on a species that has been reduced in number by over 80% of its high way back when in the 80s. We're seeing the same exact thing happen to the pollinators. The monarch butterfly. I mean, it's just inconceivable to me that there might be a day where my great, great nieces and nephews wouldn't get to see a monarch butterfly. I mean, how many people have gone through a science class where they've actually had a caterpillar and grown it into a monarch butterfly and released it? Many, many, many people understand about monarch butterflies. And, you know, to know that we're losing all that habitat and that we're going to lose a species or we're, you know, close to losing a species because we just don't have all the right things in place for them anymore. things have changed so much.
That's eye-opening. Holy cow. It's changed that much since you first started?
So it has. And you know, with monarch butterflies and their unique way that they live in their life cycle, you just really have to provide exactly what they need. And we've just become so much more efficient at farming. And we've just not left those odd areas or those edges, same thing that quail needs. We just haven't left much of that for wildlife anymore. And we've become way more efficient with our farming. And we just don't seem to be looking out for those species as much as we used to. And so we're kind of taking a hard check now and really looking at it. And the same things that got us to where we're at now are not going to be the things that help us with the whole problem. We have got to think beyond our traditional small thinking and really start thinking about these on a larger scale, more diverse habitat projects, higher quality seed mixes, more of them in more places. There's just a lot of things we can be doing to increase habitat for pollinators. And I think people are starting to realize that it's becoming a real issue. And you know, tying pollinators back to quail, the habitat's almost identical for what I talked about when I talked about brood rearing habitat. It's almost identical for what you want to see for quail and for your monarch butterflies and your bees.
Can you explain a little bit the life cycle of the monarch butterfly? Because that's something like their generations and what they're doing, where they're traveling to. It's just all a pretty amazing cycle that happens there. But I know you could probably explain it better than I can.
Sure. A lot of people don't know either how the monarch butterfly works. You know, we're used to things migrating and different species doing different things. And with the monarch butterfly, they fly from Mexico, say up into Texas. And that's what we call the first generation. They hatch an egg on a common milkweed plant. So over 90% of monarch butterflies are hatched off of a common milkweed plant. So that's what they like to lay their eggs on. That's where you're going to see most of them come off of. So that's a plant that's really in need across the range. So they'll lay that first egg on a common milkweed plant in Texas. They'll lay a bunch of them. Then they'll die. Then that monarch butterfly that comes out of that caterpillar is hatched, grows into a monarch. It's, you know, goes through its whole stages of larval growth, and then it becomes a butterfly. Then it'll fly up north to, say, Missouri. Then that'll be generation. It'll then lay a third generation, and it will die. And then the Missouri one will hatch out. It'll fly up north, maybe to Minnesota, maybe to North Dakota. You know, it'll just keep going up, maybe up to Canada. And then it will lay an egg on a common milkweed plant also, and then it will die. So this fourth generation one that then hatches out will fly all the way back to Mexico. So this is a monarch that has never seen Mexico, doesn't know about avocados, and doesn't even know where it's going, but it flies back to the same Oyamel fir forest in Mexico where four generations before had flown from.
It's incredible.
It is just crazy. So you have to provide the common milkweed. You have to provide all of the food sources, the fuel for that monarch to get all the way back to Mexico. So you have to have a lot of nectar resources in September and October still available for them to fuel their flight all the way back to Mexico. And then you have to just pray for really good weather down there, because if you get a really cold snap and you get any kind of bad weather, all those monarchs, thousands and thousands of them will die with a really bad cold spell down there, because they pack into that fir forest. They go to that same mountaintop in Mexico every year. New generations go to that same place, and they just cluster in huge numbers. If you have a chance to look it up on the internet, look up that Oyamel fir forest and look up the just the video of those monarchs all wintering there. It's crazy. And that's how
it would be a beautiful sight.
Courtney, they do their population surveys by counting how much of that forest is taken over by these overwintering monarchs. They measure it. It's incredible. It's just it's a neat story.
What about with bees? What are they going through?
Sure. So there's a lot of different bees out there, you know, native bees. There's hundreds of species. But for us in at the Bee and Butterfly Habitat Fund, we work with a lot of actual honeybee producers. They helped start this fund and help fund it, either the habitat projects. And so we work with the honeybee folks a lot. And for honeybees, you know, they're just an interesting social structure for the bees, but they've been having a hard time of it as well, with colony collapse disorder. They have issues with pesticides. They have issues with a little mite called the varroa mite, which can cause really bad problems with your honeybee colonies. So they're facing some issues as well. And most of their issues are related to lack of forage. If they have good quality forage, that gets them healthier to make it through the winter. So when we do our projects on the Bee and Butterfly Fund, we always plant half of our project to a, what we call a honeybee mixture. And it's heavy to the clovers. And then the other half of our project is a native wildflower mix that's very highly diverse, over 40 species. And in some cases, it's over 60 species of different wildflowers. So we try and hit both needs, both the needs of the different the monarchs and also the needs of the honeybees and the native bees when we do these plantings with our cooperators.
So, I mean, a typical seed mix doesn't have that many different species in it, right? Aren't there only like three or four?
Well, yeah, yeah. It's a struggle, I tell you, as a biologist, Courtney.
Okay, okay.
Bravo. So the more diversity you have in a planting, the more likely you are to benefit more pollinators. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be like the regal fritillary has to have violets. We don't put violets in our seed mixes because violets do not often do well grown from seed. They're better as a potted plant coming in. But that's just an example. Every species that you add, every species of wildflower, native wildflower that you add to a mix, just makes it more likely that more different pollinators will use it. So it's a really neat program that we have where we try to use a high quality habitat standard. That's what we call it within our world, and we try to make the most diverse seed mix that we can that's native to that area. And provide it for those landowners. And yeah, if it's a really wet area or something, you might get a few species in that mix that aren't going to express themselves. Or if it's a super dry area, you might not get a few species. But, you know, if we can start out with 69 wildflower species, you know, maybe we'll have 60 or 62 of them express themselves. And that is how much better than four or five or six. Just, it's an incredible benefit to try and improve those seed mixtures and get them to be much more diverse.
Right. And I'm just thinking that of the different states. So in it's Seed a Legacy program. How many different states do you guys work with? Is that limited?
Yeah. So when we started in 2014. Yeah. I think they started originally with Pheasants Forever as a partner in 2014, I believe, and started with two pilot states, North Dakota and South Dakota. And we've moved on from there. We've grown since that pilot year. We've got a lot of projects on the ground now, and we have expanded into 12 states. And what we've done is kind of take like an overlap approach of we put an area on the map that was really important to honeybee producers for summer bee use, for keeping their hives healthy through the spring and the summer. And then we overlapped that with the monarch butterfly migration routes. and the states that were most important for that. And we came up with those 12 states that we are now working with projects within. Okay. And Courtney, we work in some other arenas. Like I said, we do some of the solar work. When we work with a solar project, we put the honeybee mix under the panels because it's a shorter mix. And then we do the wildflower mix outside of the panels on maybe the drive or the edge or something. So we're still getting the benefits from both seed mixes. And we do those projects elsewhere outside of the 12 states. But other than that, we, you know, when it's just the Seed of Legacy program, we work within those 12 state boundaries.
Okay. How many acres does somebody need to be able to apply for this program?
Sure. We do a 2-acre minimum. And because there's a lot of other things you can do on a smaller acreage, and that's just our niche. We do 1 acre of the honeybee and 1 acre of the butterfly. And that's how we package our seed. And that's what we've chosen to use as our lower level is 2 acres. Now, if you had an acre and the neighbor had an acre and you wanted to do two together, close together, we'd be willing to work with you on that. We're nothing if not flexible. We try to be super flexible and work with people on projects. But we're not in it for the small yard project, because there's a lot of other people out there to help with those resources. Mm-hmm. So we just, we have kind of taken our niche. That's the 2 acres and more. We're doing a large solar project. I think that's going to be several hundred acres coming up this year. And our average project size last year was something like 8.5 acres per landowner. So we do them from any size from 2. For the free seed portion of our program, that's from 2 to 25 acres.
What about like site prep? If somebody wants to, if they apply for the program and they're accepted, is that what you would say?
Sure.
That they need to do to prepare, like how far in advance and what?
Well, this probably you hit on. I'm really glad you asked this question, because you hit on what is the most important part of probably the entire project is site prep. If a project goes south or does not work out well, we can almost always point back to it being not prepped correctly. Mm-hmm. So for us, site prep is probably the most important thing. Of projects that are applied for where the site prep is done correctly, we have accepted every project that we have been requested to work with. So if the site prep is there, we are willing to work on your project with you. And for site prep, for us, we have a unique theory on it that we've developed over years and years and years of working with private landowners and working on projects. For us, we have a project or a plan called the Gold Plan. And the Gold Plan involves putting in soybeans for one growing season prior to doing a dormant seeding of your pollinator planting. So that means in the spring, you're going to find a landowner or find a neighbor or do it yourself, if you do it yourself, that can put soybeans in the ground that you're wanting to plant your pollinator plot in. And then once those soybeans are harvested or we can even, you know, put the seed on, even if the soybeans didn't get harvested. But that seed will be put on as a dormant seeding that you can then just broadcast into the soybean stubble in November, December, somewhere around there. And then that wildflower seed freezes and thaws all winter long. It finds its way into the seed to the soil horizon where it needs to be. And it is ready to germinate and be ready to go come March or April, depending on your area.
When's the best time to apply for the program? Would you apply the fall before that?
We're pretty flexible on the applications. We do have like a March 1st deadline for the spring. And then I think we have a September deadline for the fall program. But what happens most of the time, Courtney, is people will end up applying and then calling and then they realize, well, like I got a lot of applications this spring, my March 1st deadline, I had a lot of applications that were in existing grass currently, and those will never be ready for a fall planting this next year. They're just not. They wouldn't be ready for a spring planting. I'm sorry. They would be ready for a fall planting if we can do the soybeans, but they wouldn't, they were trying to apply for a spring planting, but they were currently in grass right now. And that you can't kill grass and get a good seed bed, in a month or two. It takes, you know, it would take the entire summer of some type of treatment for you to be able to plant in the fall.
What about upkeep once it is planted?
Yeah.
What, I mean, like, I don't know. I don't have a green thumb myself.
Yep.
So, but it's also because I'm not necessarily given instructions of,
sure.
What do you guys ask?
Yeah. So because it's mostly, because the clover's a really great mix, and it's I'll call it kind of aggressive. That doesn't mean it's going to take everything over. It just means it's going to keep its space. So you don't need to do very much with that. Then usually it doesn't allow too many weeds to grow up in there. But the wildflower mix is needs a little more growing space and a little bit more growing time. So what you want to do is manage that first year with a few mowings to kind of take the tops of the weeds off that are trying to grow up in there. Because invariably, you're going to end up with some weeds that try and come up in your seed mix. But if you've done a good job of site prep, you shouldn't have a lot of grass competition. We have brome and fescue here where I'm at, and that's a problem in a lot of places as a monoculture that doesn't do a really great job of providing bare ground and opening the ground up. So you want to get rid of all the grasses and as many weeds as you can. And then that first year, that first spring and kind of into the summer, you just need to kind of mow a little bit and make sure that you're getting rid of the weeds that are there, so that your wildflowers have a better chance of really doing a good job of setting down their root system and being ready to really jump forward the second year.
We
say with those type of plantings that the first year they creep, the second year they the first year they sleep. I'm sorry, the first year they sleep, the second year they creep, and the third year they leap. So by year three, you're going to see some awful nice wildflowers in that planting. And they should be expressing themselves, and it should be a really nice planting at that point.
What about for our bird dogs? Is the seed mix okay for our dogs to be running in, training in?
That's a good question. We do have some rye in there, and as someone, it adds a mix. It adds a mix that provides some diversity, but it's not at a very high level. And in some of the mixes, we don't have it. So, you know, I've looked at it from that side of things, because the pointer that I first told you about, my first pointer, the couch eater, the couch eater actually got nocardia. She had that grass on infection. And at 9 years old, we had to remove one lobe of her lung, and she almost died on the table. So I have, some knowledge about the Mean Seeds and the Mean Seeds program. We do not include a high level of grasses in any of our mixes. Our mixes are generally very high to the wildflower component and very, very low to the grass component. We like to put enough grass in there, Courtney, that we can run a prescribed fire through it, but that's about it.
Okay. No, that's really good to know. And I know that's a concern that I've read a few times on just different kind of grass mixes and what is okay to run dogs through and not.
Sure.
Because I know some of them are really good for birds.
Yes.
So yeah. Is that's different from the pollinators though? Because they don't need that so much.
To be honest with you, the grasses, you know, most of the grasses we're talking about that do cause some of the seed on problems, and I'm not the expert on this, so forgive me if I'm getting it a little bit wrong, but I think are most of the wild ryes.
Okay.
The ryes have kind of an on that's really aggressive. And then there's a few others that would be in there as well. But for the most part, quail don't need much grass. And I know that your listeners are from all over and you're, you know, chucker country too and that kind of thing. But for us in the Midwest, quail don't need a ton of grass. So our pollinator mixes are even better because they just have so many wildflowers in them and so few grasses. And it's not the wildflowers issues usually, it's the grass on issues, I think, that cause most of the problem.
Mm-hmm. So what type of properties would be most ideal for this program, and on vice versa, what would be not? And I look at myself being in Montana, dry here. What, and I don't know what our monarch population is like. I know I have plenty of bees here. But what, can you tell me a little bit about that? What would be more ideal and not?
Well, for us, you know, we like to work on, we work on small projects to large projects, you know, 2 acres. We have a 2 acre suburban planting where it was in the middle of the city, and a gentleman owned both lots and he wanted to turn it into great pollinator habitat. So he literally had a neighbor from out in the country come in and plant soybeans and site prepped it. So we've got images on our site of, you know, this planting being done in a city, you know, where they actually had a 2 acre plot that he put in the bee and butterfly habitat fund.
That's awesome.
Adjacent to crop fields is great. You know, kind of a field that's off by itself, you know, that you don't want to farm anymore, that's small. Those are always good ones. We get a lot of people that have bought a new property and want to put in just a couple acres, maybe around the drive and around the backside. We have some farms that are putting in solar panels and they want to do the work around the solar panels. We're working with a prison in Iowa, a corporate sustainability campus in Iowa, in Des Moines, that are doing some walking trails. We're actually working with a dog rescue in Minnesota that are doing some plantings out back in an area that they want to walk their dogs and have their volunteers exercise the animals. So, you know, almost anything will work for the project. And if you got, you know, any size, and I did say earlier, we work on 2 acres or more, but you can make a difference for pollinators on a small property too. I mean, here at my house, I have planted a bunch of swamp milkweed because common milkweed and swamp milkweed are really high on the list of species that monarchs like to lay their eggs on. And I counted 14 caterpillars on my 3 swamp milkweed plants this year.
Wow.
So we get quite a few just come in here, you know, to just use the swamp milkweed. So mm-hmm. you can do things on your own. You don't have to have a whole big acreage to do it.
Yeah. So, that's what I was wondering too. Just somebody that maybe has, you know, a small area in their backyard, even living in town.
Yep.
I mean, is that will still make a difference?
It really will, because, you know, every monarch caterpillar that's produced, you know, as long as they're not predated, then they're going to, you know, hopefully make more, and then they're going to move on and, you know, be just another one for us. And these smaller plantings, I think Monarch Watch does some work with the smaller plantings. They might even provide some milkweed seeds or milkweed plugs, depending on what you're doing. There are a lot of resources out there if you'll look for it to do these smaller plantings as well. I just would err on the side of kind of go with native plants if you can, because if you're going to plant a few just in your yard, just plant things you know they're going to use. Like, everybody likes butterfly weed and black-eyed Susans, but honestly, the monarchs don't love them. So I try to go with swamp milkweed or common milkweed, and because they seem to like that a little bit better.
Okay. What about with bees? What's the difference with them? How do I keep them off the deck and into the yard?
So provide more habitat away from the deck that they will focus on. And for bees, it's a little bit different because they really like to kind of go after a food source and really use it as it's blooming heavily. Like, you'll see them in alfalfa fields or clover fields. When the bloom is on, you'll just see like thousands of bees using that. And that's kind of what they like to do. They'll actually come back to the hive and do like this little dance. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen in the world. They do this little dance that actually shows the other bees the direction of where all this buffet of food is available right now that's blooming. Like, they'll find the giant blooming area where everything's blooming in those clovers, and they will come back, tell the hive, and the hive in its entirety pretty much will go over, feed on that, you know, grab the pollen, and then really take advantage of those blooms that are occurring all at once. Bees are interesting individuals.
So tell us the name of the website and the process of how to apply for this from and how that looks, how it works.
It's called the Bee and Butterfly Habitat Fund. And our website is just www.beeandbutterflyfund.org.
Okay.
And the program is called Seed a Legacy Program. And it'll be a little orange button that you push, and then it will take you to your state, to the application process in your state. And it's really a simple process. And I'm the one you would end up talking to about doing your program anyway. So you can always just give me a call. And I work with every landowner that we work with on the projects, one-on-one. At least we have a phone call, and, you know, to assess where they're at and how much more help they need or don't need. Some folks are really good at this and some folks are just starting out. So we're able to help you either way and get that project started. But for us, site prep is the biggest thing. And Courtney, I think I shared with you to share with the readers that we do have a few webinars that have been actually recorded, and they're available on YouTube. So you could actually watch, you know, it's about an hour long that kind of explains the program. And there's some questions that are asked at the end by some of the landowners, and we try our best to answer those questions.
Perfect. And I'm going to have all these links, everything we talked about today, in the show notes as well, and available on the website, so people have easy access to get to that. Before I let you go, Elsa, I want to know what your favorite game bird recipe is, and especially quail, since you are like the quail connoisseur.
Like, I love quail, but I will tell you, I have a different game bird recipe, but I haven't tried it with quail yet. I was able to go to Nebraska and help with a first time grouse hunters event. And I brought Hatch, and Hatch was able to help the one lady that went on our team actually harvest her first two sharptail. And of the group, we were the only ones that got birds. And I said, I felt like I was cheating a little bit, because my dogs get to go to summer camp in the Dakotas, and they had spent the previous 6 weeks chasing sharptail. And so they were really ready for it. Like, they didn't need any kind of like, hey, one day we're teaching you about the sandhills. They were like, yep, we know it, we're going. And so Hatch was able to get a couple birds for her. And the best tasting sharptail I think I've ever had was made that day. We cooked it over the fire, and it was a peach whiskey recipe. And it was, peaches were just so ripe and they were so perfect. And it had whiskey in it, and it had cream in it. And it was really incredible. And I will find that and share it with you.
So yes, please do, because sharptail have become my new favorite for eating. They're amazing. And I've never been a real dark meat fan, but they have changed my mind. And I think it's just because you have to prepare them properly.
I'm betting this recipe will be just as good with quail. I mean, I'm sure it was a really great recipe.
Okay.
And maybe because we were tired and we'd had such a great day, but it was a lot of fun.
And you probably have some good rabbit recipes too with your, with your beagles.
Yep.
So what's your favorite, how to prepare rabbit?
I like rabbit enchiladas. They're probably my favorite. And my husband makes a really, really good rabbit sausage, like a breakfast sausage. It's like way better than pork for me. I just love it.
If I have to get those from you too, I have a couple rabbits in the freezer from this past season, and I was going to do chili, but as it's warming up here, I'm thinking not. I want something a little bit different.
Well, I'm a big fan. Hatch's name comes from Hatch, New Mexico, which is kind of the, you know, world renowned for its green chili. And so I'm a big, huge green chili fan. And I just love to make green chili enchiladas. So
awesome. Yeah. So where are you off to next? Where can we find you in the next coming weeks?
Well, I'm headed out actually this weekend to a local trial for my local, the Heart of America German Shorthair Club. And then I've got another trial in Kansas coming up soon. and just, you know, generally trying to get our habitat projects going. So mm-hmm. It's the right time of the year. I'm doing some prescribed burning, which I'm really super excited about getting to help with those projects. Those are a lot of fun.
Yeah. What is it with biologists loving burns?
We are a bunch of pyromaniacs, I believe.
Totally.
It's part of it. You have to, I don't know. I didn't fit into the, you have to drink coffee and Mountain Dew into that part of the world, you know, as a biologist, but I certainly do fit into the loving prescribed fire.
Yeah, it seems backwards to an outsider of you guys are working so hard to build this habitat and there you go burning it. But it comes back tenfold, doesn't it?
It does, and it sets back the stuff that you don't want to see. You know, a field for quail that starts to get goldenrod in it, you know, lots of goldenrod, the year after that, it's not going to be very useful for quail because it's not going to be very open. So prescribed fire, really, every 2 or 3 years, at least with our rainfall here in the Midwest, in this part of the Midwest, every other year or so, a good prescribed fire is going to set you back and get all your annuals and your forbs and your really good stuff coming right back up again. So we really enjoy prescribed fire. It's a cheap tool. And then you just have to have good fire breaks. And, you know, one example of using our honeybee mix on the 50% of the project you use it on, you put it around your wildflower planting like a picture frame, and then you can use that. It stays green and you can use it as a prescribed fire break. So there's benefits, all kinds of benefits for doing things that way.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything else you wanted to add that we haven't touched on?
Courtney, I think we touched on everything.
Okay. I think we did. I think we could have gone on more and more too, because I love talking about it all with you. You, like I said, you have like two different episode topics here and one that we covered, and it's been awesome.
Well, it certainly has been great talking with you. And I know that hopefully some of your audience will be within our target area, you know, those 12 states, and we can help work with them.
Yeah. Awesome.
You know, there's room on every farm and home for wildlife management. There's space there. You can do something beneficial for wildlife. So we want to help you do that.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Elsa. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Courtney. And I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it and tag me and someone that would benefit from listening. Please help me out by giving the podcast a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening from, and hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to join me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're interested in some Bird Dog Babe swag or gear that I rely on, be sure to check out the store on thebirddogbabe.com. And most importantly, don't forget to support the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt.